dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. I'm Lynn Gary. Yesterday was Earth Day, and today women marched in Washington, D.C. to protest the right-wing government's attempt to roll back hard-won gains under law. This election season, pollsters ask voters which issue they consider of top importance. The economy, the war, the environment, and so on. But the degradation of our biosphere, an economy of haves and have-nots, and resource wars under the guise of high-flown ideologies or bogus threats are part and parcel of a civilization based on hierarchy and commodification. Our featured speaker tonight, environmentalist and author Derek Jensen, argues that this civilization cannot save the environment or itself and must be brought down. Also, we conclude our readings from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. But first, a brief report from Israel and Palestine from Grace Ritter, an Ithaca resident who traveled to the Middle East with a peace delegation to be present for the release of Israeli anti-nuclear activist and whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu earlier this week. Vanunu had been in prison for the last 18 years after he made public Israel's secret nuclear weapons program. We spoke to Grace last Wednesday as she and other international peacemakers were on a bus en route to Bethlehem, on their way to the occupied territories where Palestinians are resisting Israel's construction of a 30-foot-high security wall, hundreds of miles long, that cuts Palestinian communities in half.
I am between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv on the highway. I am here with about 100 supporters of Mordechai Vanunu, and we have been vigiling outside of Ashkelon prison for the last 2 days. Today, at about 11:30, he was released from prison to a huge crowd of supporters and also counter-demonstrators. But he has had to find a safe space to go. A church in Jerusalem called St. George's Cathedral offered him sanctuary because the situation is very dangerous for him. And definitely at the prison today, we saw that there's a very, very violent sentiment towards him. So it's not safe for him to be living in a place where people are, who knows what people are going to be doing. But today at the prison, when he was released, people were trying to encourage him to get right into a car and be driven to a safe spot. But he walked out into the courtyard, and he was still within the prison walls, but he went up to the gate of the prison, and he climbed up on the gate and waved at everyone and made the peace sign and just opened himself up as a person of peace and unafraid of the people who were chanting against him. Then he spoke to his supporters. He had a huge smile on his face, was full of dignity. And to see someone who spent that much time in prison in solitary confinement and to meet them, it's very amazing, and to see that he still has this belief in the goodness of humanity, very warm. And we're also going to be going into the West Bank tomorrow and to work with Palestinian people who are also facing great hardship.
You spoke about the violent sentiment. I mean, what is that like?
Many of our group have T-shirts that say Vanunu on them or stuff like that, and walking down the street in Jaffa, many, many people would yell at them or make rude comments. And today at the vigil, there was a very large group of counter-demonstrators. They were chanting very inflammatory things, like, you should be killed just like Brindisi, or at one point they were throwing eggs at us, or once he got into the car and was driven away, they all charged after the car. The media coverage here, mostly it seems totally not in his favor, and it just seems like the majority of the people here are not standing with him. And it seems like a really, really horrible thing for him to face, especially the State of Israel will not grant him a passport at this point. It's one of the conditions of his release was that he would not be allowed to travel at all. That's among other things. Some of them have been lifted now. One of the restrictions was that he wouldn't be allowed to talk to any international people, any international media or people at all, and that has been lifted at this point. So that's part of the victory, and people are still going to keep working until he's given a full freedom.
They won't let him leave the country, yet it seems that the situation there for him in the country is very dangerous. Are they trying to set him up to be murdered, or what's going on there?
Well, I don't know if I would say I would go that far. I'm sure they know how dangerous the situation is, but I think that really they want to use him as an example for people in the future to not speak out against nuclear weapons. Or against other policies of the State of Israel. Use him as an example always to say, this is what happened to the Nunu, and it can happen to you too. Whatever happens to him upon release is just part of that.
Have you talked to any just ordinary people who oppose him? And if so, what do they say about him? What is their feeling that makes them so against him?
They feel that he is a traitor to the state, that he signed an oath that he would not speak about it, and he did speak about it. He broke that oath. And that that the State of Israel needs these weapons for their security, and that he's a traitor to the state because he, you know, since he doesn't want these weapons to exist. We will be heading, I think, to the Bethlehem area tomorrow, and we'll probably be in Ramallah soon, because there's a lot of resistance to the wall being built around there, particularly in a place called Bidu, B-I-D-D-U. People are going out every single day, Palestinians and internationals, to resist the wall being built. We'll probably end up around there at some point.
And are people doing blockading of the construction equipment, or what's happening there?
In many communities, every single day, the people of the village go out. A lot of times they're led by the women and children, sort of as a nonviolent force. Hopefully the soldiers wouldn't want to hurt women and children as readily as other people. But then people go out and stand in front of the bulldozers that are erecting this wall. Or, you know, do many different things. It then quite often turns into a scene where the soldiers are shooting tear gas and rubber bullets and sometimes live ammunition into the crowd. There have been a couple of Palestinians killed recently in Bidu during these protests from live ammunition used on protesters. Many internationals are there, and really, people in the U.S. need to know about what is happening with their tax dollars. A huge wall is being built to imprison a whole population of people, and it's a racist policy. It's a horrible policy. It's against many, many different U.N. policies. And
how do the U.S. taxpayer dollars figure into it?
Israel is the number one recipient of U.S. military aid. They receive somewhere between $4 and $5 billion a year in U.S. military aid.
This sounds like a very dangerous situation that you're going into, Grace. How do you personally feel about that? Are you afraid? I mean, people have been killed. Rachel Corey was run over by a bulldozer. Other people have been shot, other internationals.
I think that it's important to know those risks. And yes, I expect I'll be very nervous, but I also feel that it's definitely responsibility of Americans to be there because of what our government does all over the world. People are very, very angry with the U.S. government. We need to let the world know that the people in the U.S. are not calling for these policies, and that we really need to stand in solidarity with the people who these policies are being put on and take those risks with them, as well as being willing to risk what the U.S. service people in Iraq are risking. In the name of war and destruction, they're risking death and risking killing people. And so in the name of life and peace, I feel like I should put my body in the way.
Grace Ritter speaking last Wednesday from Israel. The talk we're about to hear by Derek Jensen was given in February at the Synergy 2004 Third Annual Sustainable Living Conference at Evergreen University in Olympia, Washington.
Oh, this, by the way, is how I know we're not going to have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. So I'm not really sure what we should do today. I had a few ideas. We could either talk about the culture of make-believe, or we could sort of go straight to Q&A, or we could talk about the book I'm working on right now, which is a book about how to take down civilization. Yes. I have to tell you, it is so good to be back in the West, because of the response you just gave. I just did an East Coast tour, New England, and whenever I would say that my new book is about how to take down civilization, they would all look at me and go, So it's so great to be back where people know what the hell's going on. So I was thinking that since we have a choice, since there's multiple things we could do, that since we live in a democracy, that's actually my best joke of the afternoon, we could take a vote. And then I would just go ahead and ignore you and do whatever the hell I want to do anyway. I'll tell you why there is not going to be an anarchist revolution. Because I was down in Florida a couple years ago doing a talk, and then afterwards about 10 or 11, that was about 12 or 13 of us anarchists were going to go out to dinner. We stood in the parking lot for 45 minutes trying to come to consensus on who was going to get in which car. And we never did. Actually, we never did come to consensus. Finally, this one woman said, okay, you three this car, you four this car, you three this car. I'm like, cool, great. So that's how the revolution is going to come, is just this woman has to call it. So that said, we did get, I was sort of thinking it might be kind of fun to just go straight to Q&A, but it was a really positive response for the takedown civilization stuff. So why don't I just, yeah, for which? Okay. The people have spoken. Can somebody make the lighting less terrible? I'm very dim. I was bright and then I got dim. I was at Syracuse, New York last spring, and we couldn't make the AV system work. And I don't think you can say you've lived until you've seen a half dozen anarcho-primitivists try to work an AV system. So is this better? Are we happy now? Okay. So are you gonna stay here on call? Or are you gonna?
Is there anything else anyone needs?
Hey, can we do stereo effects? Okay, so what I'm doing with the new book, it's pretty funny because after language, which was pretty big, and then culture, which was really big, my former publisher challenged me to write a short book, so I wrote two, and then this new book on how to take down civilization, I think I'm on page 526, I think. I'm about halfway done. It's another big one. Okay, so what I'm doing in the new book is I'm going through and I'm stating my premises in boldface. And the reason I'm doing that is because I've heard it said that the first rule of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. So, for example, and I don't want to do that. So, for example, if you hear a talking head say, how can we best make the U.S. economy grow? Okay, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? But they've got you asking different questions. Of Hitler, it was said that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And that's really true, once again. Once you accept certain premises, you can go ahead and commit whatever atrocities you want and have them fully rationalized. And once again, I don't want to do that. Okay, so we're going to jump tracks here, which is not going to surprise anybody who's read any of my books. And we're going to go a different direction for a second. And I think it's pretty safe to say that the environmental movement is an abysmal failure. And almost no matter what measure you go by, we're not winning. We don't even slow, not only do we not slow the rate of deforestation, we don't even slow the rate of acceleration of deforestation. And I'm sure you know that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service did give an important response to that. And NIMS, of course, is the organization that is tasked with overseeing the murder of the oceans. And what his response was just a direct quote, "We have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable." As a longtime grassroots environmental activist and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and fall into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed, and I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use that lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that horses were afraid to get in the water for fear that, well, because they were afraid, and maybe so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize? So large they'd keep people awake at night with the slapping of their tails against the water. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time. The death of flocks of Eskimo crews just as large. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take dioxin in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take global warming. Give me a specific threshold, Derek, a specific point at which you finally use that word." Thanks, George. So I read a really interesting book a few years ago called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And in this book, he asked the question, how is it that these people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go in and participate in a death camp? And he found something very interesting, which is that many of the doctors actually acted in the best interests of the Jews. And they did everything they could to help improve the condition of the Jews, except question the larger framing conditions in which they found themselves. So if a Jew got sick, they might hand him an aspirin to lick, or they might put him to bed for a couple days. Or if he had a contagious disease, they might kill him so that he wouldn't give this disease to others. And his point was that they were doing all these wonderful things that they could. Wonderful is kind of ironic, but they were doing the best they could within the Auschwitz reality. They weren't questioning assembly line mass murder. They weren't questioning working them to death, starving them to death. They weren't questioning the overall cultural racism that led to this. And I think a lot of us as environmentalists end up finding ourselves in similar positions, that we're doing what pathetically little is available to us without questioning the larger superstructure. So that's one of the things I want to do today, is try to sort of blow out that superstructure as much as possible. Okay, premise one of the current book is industrial civilization. We got off the word industrial, but industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. A few years ago, I was riding a car with a friend of mine, George Raffin, and I was just making conversation. I said, so if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George can be kind of a curmudgeon, and that day he was in kind of a foul mood and said, you know, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the only level of technology that's sustainable is the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question is what's going to be left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources isn't going to last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources, whereby there are fewer salmon who come back every year than the year before, isn't sustainable. In fact, you can also say, and I think this is really true, that any way of life based on the use of resources isn't sustainable, because resources don't actually exist. There is no such thing as a resource. What there are salmon whose lives are as valuable to them as ours are to us, and trees whose lives are as valuable to them as ours are to us, and rivers whose lives are as valuable to them. And it's only after they're converted to resources. It's like there's this great line by this Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And what that means is when he looks at trees, he doesn't see trees. He sees, obviously, dollar bills. He sees resources. And if you see them as resources, you're going to use them up. And this doesn't mean, and we're jumping again, no surprise, but this doesn't mean that you can't eat them, you can't kill them. A few years ago, I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington, and the radio interviewer said, well, you know, Indians ate salmon too. Oh, no, I'm sorry, he didn't say that. He said, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew it was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, so I had to give an answer. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to a tree, and I asked the tree, so what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer just like that, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I eat salmon from a particular run, I'm now responsible for that run's continuation. And if a grizzly bear eats salmon, they're now responsible for that continuation. And this is true on a moral level, it's true on a spiritual level, it's true on a physical level, because if you don't do it, the run's not going to continue, as we see. And everybody knows this. Wood ducks know it, tadpoles know it, frogs know it, grizzly bears know it, everybody but us. Everybody but a few of us. Okay, so that's fine, Derek, that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. But what is civilization? You know, I've been bashing civilization for about 10 years, and I figure it's finally time I better define it. And the definition that I've come up with, which I think is really defensible, is civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's really fine, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. The first of them is, which means, by the way, that the Talawa and Yurok who lived and still live where I live weren't civilized. They lived in villages, they lived in camps. And I'm using civilization as pejorative, by the way. And they didn't require the importation of resources. The Talawa and Yurok would eat salmon, huckleberry, salal, salmon, elk, salmon, crabs, salmon, clams, salmon, 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 salmon. They would also, I don't know if you know this, but they'd also eat salmon. And anyway, so a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is your way of life is not and can never be sustainable. Because if you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, once again, I don't believe in resources, but it's shorthand here. If you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, that means that, and you require its importation, as your city grows, you're going to denude an ever larger area of that particular resource, as we see. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over aren't going to trade you for this item, and if you need it, you're going to take it. And so what this means is that we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and it wouldn't matter the U.S. would still have a large military, because how the hell else are we going to get access to all the oil that we need? So we could all hold hands and sing Give Peace a Chance, and the military is going to march on. Okay. The second premise of the book is that traditional communities don't often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. Following quick on that is the third premise. Our way of living is based on, requires, and would collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Oh, and then we get to a really fun one. This is a great premise. Okay, civilization is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is either transparent or fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And the way this can work on a family level, those of you who've read Language know that my father's extremely violent. Broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And within our family, the violence would flow that direction. He could be violent with impunity. But the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he'd committed blasphemy. And similarly, I don't know if it's been in the paper here, all over New England people had heard about this, that a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, there was a mountain biker killed by a mountain lion down in L.A. And this, of course, makes news everywhere. But not many people know that they're building houses on some of the last Florida panther habitat in Florida. And so it's very, you know, one time, you know, the one time that a shark bites a human, that's a big deal. But sharks are being driven systematically extinct. And, you know, I don't really like Bob Melvin. I think he should be fired. It's a baseball joke. So similarly, there's you know, when there were 3,000 people killed on 9/11, that's a big deal. But there's more people than that die of preventable cancer in the United States every like 3 or 4 days. There's more children than that die around the world because of U.S. domestic and foreign policies every same deal 3 or 4 days. And so there's this fetishization of the victims when it goes the other direction. The fifth premise of the book is that the property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives below. So those above can acquire more property, that is make more money, by destroying the lives of those below. But if those below destroy the property of those above, then the lives, and that's called, the first is called production, by the way, and if those below damage the property of those above can destroy the lives of those below, and that's called justice. And we all know the example, you know, Jeff Lures, 22 years for torching 3 SUVs, and which is far more than you get if a man rapes a woman or if a man beats his wife to death, his wife. So that's that hierarchy in operation. The sixth premise is a fun one, too. Civilization isn't redeemable. Our culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. I ask people all over the country, do you think that our culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh, even in New England. And so the question becomes, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know, because we don't talk about it, because we spend so much time trying to pretend that we have hope. And it's killing us. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and they co-opted hope. And one of the ways they did that was by making it so that it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist at every step of the process. So, would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to move to a ghetto? You want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to get on a cattle car? Want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something really interesting. which is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. Oh, we're going to jump another direction too, which is the 10th premise of the book is that the culture as a whole, most of its members are insane. I don't really need to talk about that, do I? If I could get across one thing in my work, it would be that the government is a government of occupation and the culture is a culture of occupation. And of course, all of my American Indian friends are telling me what the hell took me so long to figure that one out. I'll read a short little thing from the new book, if I can find it. Okay, here we go. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Yeah, we'd think about the baseball season. What would we all do if they implemented... Goddamn Grady Little, by the way, for keeping Pedro Martinez in. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. That was Mussolini, by the way, not Chomsky. And what would we do if they then instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males from the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist, or following Mussolini, corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Oh, I'll tell you my secret fantasy, which won't be secret after this, which is that the next time they have one of those WTO or FTAA or whatever meetings, that all the cops suddenly turn around and they start shooting at the WTO representatives. Because they have a lot more in common with us than they do with them. And that's happened before. That actually happened. It was in 1880 in Pennsylvania. The militia handed over their guns to the strikers. It also happened at the Bastille, where when they stormed the Bastille, all the guards suddenly turned and killed their officers, which should always be encouraged. So would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because... Hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forests, and from there to the boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them the marching orders? It's like, we're all so crazy. If space aliens came down from outer space, I guess that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically deforest the planet, to vacuum the oceans, and to give dioxin, to put dioxin in every mother's breast milk, every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Every stream. I mean, it's amazing what we can do when we put our minds to it. And if they did that, I mean, what would we do? I mean, I think it's pretty clear that if space aliens were doing all of this, that we would all just put on our camo outfits and grab our AK-47s and head off to the woods. Am I like the only person here with an AK-47? Or has anybody seen the movie Red Dawn? Oh, isn't that the greatest? I love that movie. Okay, the movie is about the commies invade from Central America. The Cubans and Soviets come in through Nicaragua. They fly up to the United States. They don't fly United, and they never get here. And they get stopped in Colorado by a bunch of jocks and cheerleaders. And I think we should make that our theme movie, except just dub it. And every time they say commies, just put in capitalists, and there we go. That was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'll fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? How many people in here have loved someone who's died of cancer? No, I'm not going to say that. How many people have loved someone who got killed by cancer? That's what, 70, 80%? Which, of course, cancer is a disease of civilization. Who is the idiot who came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food? Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? The head of South African security, after South Africa was no longer apartheid, the head of security before then said that the thing he'd really been afraid of with the ANC was not their sabotage or even the violence, as it was the possibility that they would convince the mass of people to not have respect for law and order. Because he said no security force in the world can deal with that. So if we can recognize that sometimes law and morality coincide, and quite often, of course, they don't. Anyway, would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues, or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give that threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. So, when I say fight back, I don't mean only picking up guns. I mean, certainly that's one part. But the wonderful thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where we look, there's great work to be done. And so, if your heart carries you to work on a battered women's shelter, that's really important. If it carries you to work on a rape crisis hotline, that's great too. If it carries you to file timber sale appeals, great. I mean, even voting, for crying out loud. People ask me sometimes if I vote, and I say, you know, we all have these dirty habits that we're ashamed of. The thing is, there's this strategy that was used by Robert E. Lee at the Battle of Chancellorsville called Hammer and Anvil, where you take part of your army and you leave it here as the anvil, and you take part of your army here and you take it around and smash the enemy in between, and that's your hammer. And part of what I think we need to do, we have a fair number of people acting as anvils, and I don't think we have enough people acting as hammers to try to go on the offensive. All of our environmental work is really, for most part, is pretty defensive. And I mean, I can't speak for any of you, but it's not good enough for me to simply have salmon or grizzly bears or lynx or bobcat live out another generation or two of harried life before they ultimately get exterminated. You know, I want more than that. I want to actually live in a world where there's more wild salmon come back every year than the year before, and more migratory songbirds, and where there's... I'll do what it takes to get there. Which actually brings us back to hope, that one of the things that kept my mother in the relationship with my father was the false hope that he would change. And another thing that kept her in the relationship, obviously, was that there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But the main one that I want to talk about is the false hope that he would change. And I was at a dinner get-together thing not very long ago with an attorney from what used to be Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, I guess it's Earth Justice now, and also with a funder for Earth Justice. And there's some other people too there too. And the attorney was saying, you know, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things are going to be okay. And, you know, if we can just take over the House and Senate, and, you know, I was thinking, well, maybe, if it depends on who we is. I mean, if she means Democrats, then no. But I don't think she also meant storming the House and Senate either. So they're saying all this about how, you know, if we could just get a Democrat in the White House, things would be okay. And my mom was at the dinner, and she said, you know, the Democrats are just as controlled by corporations as the Republicans are. And everybody sort of leaned away and wrinkled their noses as though my mom had just explosively farted. And there was silence for a few moments, and then somebody said, I'm sorry, could you pass me the chips, please? And then, of course, I started talking about baseball. And anyway, so does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? And does anybody think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. I mean, that was what kept the Jews in line, you know, the false hope that if they are just good enough, perfect enough, that the dreadful won't happen. But I don't want to just bash false hope. I actually want to bash hope, too. I was at a talk last spring, and you know, I was just doing my fun little bashing hope thing, and somebody said in the audience said, "So can you define hope, please?" I was like, "Oh, I've never done that. I mean, I've been bashing it for years. I have no idea what it is." And so I asked the audience, "Can you come up with a definition of hope?" And they did, and it was a great definition. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Because I don't hope I'm going to eat something this evening. You know, they say males are afraid of commitment. I'm committing to it in public right here. I'm going to eat something tonight. And on the other hand, the next time I get on an airplane, I hope it doesn't crash. I have no control over that. So the point is, if you say, "I hope that salmon survive," what you're doing is you're acknowledging that you're fundamentally powerless. I don't hope that coho and Chinook salmon survive. Once again, I will do what it takes to make sure they survive. If they want to go extinct because they don't like how they're being treated, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, they're not going to go extinct because I won't allow it to happen. I mean, it's really simple. What we need to do, if we want to make sure salmon don't go extinct, once again, as long as they don't want to go extinct, and who could blame them, frankly, is we need to take out dams, we need to stop deforestation, we need to stop global warming, and we need to stop commercial fishing. And those are all very straightforward technical tasks. If this were space aliens doing it, 1, 2, 3, 4, done deal. Okay, the longer, if our culture is not going to undergo any sort of voluntary transformation, if we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm the humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. If somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 150 years ago, the people in this region would still have a lot of salmon to eat. If it would have happened 200 years ago, people in the Midwest and New England would still have passenger pigeons to eat. I mean, passenger pigeons and salmon and Eskimo curlews and all of them have the right to survive, of course, we'll talk about rights in a second, have the right to survive on their own, but even on the level of straight calories. You know, there's going to be people 50 years from now on the Columbia River, they'll be glowing for one thing, and they'll be saying, "Now there are no salmon here and I'm starving to death because you allowed those in power to have cheap electricity for beer cans." And that's not a legacy, once again, I'm willing to bear. That the longer we wait, if somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 80 years ago, there wouldn't be dioxin in every mother's breast milk. The longer we wait, the worse that's going to be. Eighth premise, the needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of our economic system. I'll say it again. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of our economic system. Can you imagine any politician saying that? It's just so, it's absolutely absurd. The psychiatrist R.D. Lang came up, oh my God, oh we have 45 minutes, good. I was thinking we had like 15 minutes left. Anyway, the psychiatrist R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also the three rules of a dysfunctional culture. Rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. And what this meant within my own family structure is that we could talk about anything we wanted except for the violence that wasn't happening. And then, of course, we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. And we also couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. And then in addition, we couldn't talk about the fact that violence wasn't happening. One more thing. We couldn't talk about the fact that violence wasn't happening. Because if we would have talked about the fact that we couldn't talk 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 about the violence that wasn't happening, there would have been violence happening for us to not be talking about. Is that clear? And on the larger social scale, we can talk for years about whether the president did or didn't get a blowjob, but we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We can talk about Pedro Martinez, and why did they spend so much on Raul Ibanez? I mean, I think he's pretty good, but in one good year, and he gets, what is it, $4 million or something? It's insane. I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes a vision of Angelina Jolie will rise up before me. She'll stand suspended in space. Makes me happy. It also makes me a little nervous, too. I don't think she has very good taste in men. Who's the new guy? God damn him. He's a bad boy too, but it's an improvement over Billy Bob. Oh my God. You know the thing about the vial? He each had a vial of the other person's blood around their neck? Do you know that? And then do you know where she has his name tattooed? Oh my God, I bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the newspaper, so it has to be true. I'm sorry, does anybody know what's the indigenous name for this place? No, this place. I'm sorry?
Cheatwood.
And what's the indigenous name? What did the indigenous people...
That's where it was.
Cheatwood. Oh, okay. 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 I find it really strange that I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's, but it took me about 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket. And then if you go another mile, there was another massacre at a place called Achillet. And if you go a mile over here, there was a massacre at a place called Lake Earl. And it's so weird that I know that Yvonne Rodriguez just signed a 4-year contract with the Detroit Tigers, and which I think is a little bit, 4 years for a catcher his age, I think is not a very good move. And I can't name 15 species of plants and animals who live within 150 yards of my home who've been harmed by civilization. I can't even name 10 species of plants who live within 100 yards of my home that are edible. Blackberry. Huckleberry. Salal. Blackberry. You know, somebody told me that, I mean, I know about dandelions, but the local dandelions actually aren't dandelions, I found out, and they're actually not, down where I live, in Northern California, they're actually not edible. I found that out. I was thinking, I know they're not plants, but it's close enough. Those big red mushrooms with the white dots, I'm thinking about trying one of them next year. Well, there's lots of them, so yeah, I could probably survive all winter on them. And they do have bites out of them, by the way. I'm thinking it's probably little rabbits or something. Anyway, I think it's really weird. Oh, and it's not just the Artie Lang's rules that make it so we don't pay attention to the things. And we're talking about the vacuuming of the oceans. Here we go. Here's a little quiz. So seeing patterns is supposed to be one form of intelligence. I'm gonna throw out this pattern. We'll see if we can recognize a pattern in less than 6,000 years. Okay, so when you think of a rack, is the first thing you think of like cedar forests that are so thick that the sunlight never reaches the ground? That's actually what I think of. The first written myth of this culture is that Gilgamesh went out and cut the forests of what is now Iraq. And then we think of Saudi Arabia, and the first thing you think of course, is dense oak forests, right? And then you go a little bit further west to like Lebanon, you think of cedars. I mean, they've got one on the flag. And then Israel, I talked to this guy from Israel a couple years ago, and I said, do you have trees in Israel? And I don't know, I've never been there. And he said, yeah, we watered them one by one. And Greece had lions and was heavily forested. Italy was heavily forested. When you think of North Africa, Libya, I mean, I think of just dense forests immediately. As this culture has metastasized across the globe, it's been deforesting its way all around. There's a great line by Plato, I believe it is. Plato observed, what now remains of the hills, compared with what then existed, is like the skeleton of a sick man, all the fat and soft earth having wasted away, and only the bare framework of the land being left. There are some mountains which now have nothing but food for bees, but they had trees not very long ago. I just read not very long ago that there was some king in England, like 13th century or something, outlawed dams because they kill salmon. And nowadays, I mean, the power planning council is still studying whether dams kill salmon. It's all pretty pathetic. Pretty bobo pathetic. Any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least, disallowing it from damaging your land base. Oh, I never finished my deal a minute ago about the perception, that it's not just R.D. Lang's rules that make it so we can't see. In the 1960s, this guy Lester Laborsky did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs, and they would track where they would look, which makes me think it was probably John Ashcroft's uncle or something. And it's like, here you go, Johnny, a nice little Christmas present. And what he found, he showed people photographs, and what he found is if the photograph contained something that the person found morally objectionable or that threatened their worldview, their eyes would never once track to it, not once. Which means that they would see it out of the corner of their eye, and they would know where not to look. So, for example, he showed people photographs. In the background was a man reading a newspaper, and the foreground was a silhouette of a woman's breast. And the people who found nudity morally objectionable, their eyes would never once track to the breast. Never once. And when they were asked later, was there a breast in the photograph, they would say no. And they weren't lying, except unconsciously to themselves, because they never saw it. They never looked there. It's like I had this friend who said she wishes she could just shake George Bush, which I like that part. And then she said, I would just say to him, you know, that you could do so much to slow deforestation or stop deforestation. How about that? So much to stop global warming, so much to stop militarization, huh? And I said to her, look, I know exactly what he would say to you. He would say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Which, of course, with George Bush would come from multiple sources. And it's like the head DEA guy in Colombia several years ago, his wife was arrested for smuggling drugs in the United States. And the story they told was that she was doing lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room and never see it. It's possible that this was a story they told to keep him out of prison. It's also possible that it would have been so threatening to his perception of their marriage that he could not see it. He absolutely couldn't see it. We don't have to go. We do this all the time. I mean, I don't know if I'm the only person in this room who's ever been in a really shitty relationship. It's nice to be among a support group. Thank you. I mean, there's nothing worse than me saying that at a talk, and it's just dead silence in the room. It's like, well, I'm feeling kind of vulnerable now. Anyway, so I mean, there was no evidence at all that she's the single most selfish person in the entire world. The evidence wasn't there. And then you may have dated the same woman. And then when any of my friends would attempt to point this out to me, I would say, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then when the thing's over, it's like, oh my God, how did they not see that? And so once again, we do that. That's how we can have 80% of us have had someone we love killed by cancer, and we still just soldier on. Did I mention, by the way, that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along? Okay, here's another premise. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. There are just people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of green paper. Those without the green papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world. A couple things about that. One of them is, well, I guess it's one thing. At a talk I did last year, afterwards, this one guy said, you know, you talk a lot about violence and this culture being based on violence, but I don't see it. You know, I'm not a violent guy. And I said, okay, first off, where's your shirt made? And he said, Bangladesh. I said, okay, do we even need to talk about that? He said, no. I said, next, do you pay rent? And he said, yes. I said, why do you pay rent? He said, because I don't own. I said, no, no, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he said, well, somebody would come and evict me. And I said, who? He said, well, sheriff. I said, what would happen if when the sheriff came, you invited them into your house? And you said, would you like some dinner? And then after dinner, you said, you know, it's been nice having you, but you're really not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave now, and I'm going to go to bed. What would the sheriff do? He said, well, the sheriff would pull out a gun, and he would force me out of the home. And I said, ah, I see. So what you're telling me is that if you don't pay rent, somebody with a gun is going to come and force you out of your home. So the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, somebody is going to do violence to you if you don't. And he said, okay, I get it. And I said, also, do you ever get hungry? He said, yeah. I said, well, when you get hungry, do you go to the grocery store? He said, yeah. And I said, well, do you start eating? There's lots of food there. And he said, no, I don't. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, because if I do, then somebody with a gun will come and take me away. And I said, yeah, it's the same guy. He's a real asshole, isn't he? the point is, I think it's really weird that we have to actually pay to exist, to live on the planet. And we have to actually pay to eat. And if you don't, some asshole wearing a uniform is going to come with a gun and take you away. That's a really, really weird thing. Some bobo, sorry. Here's a great premise. Oh, we're doing great. Here's a great premise. Love does not imply pacifism. You get this all the time. That, you know, if you love enough, then that means that you'll never do any act of violence. And, well, first off, violence is just such a weird word. There should be like 135 words for violence because there's a bazillion different types of, well, there should be a bazillion words for violence because there's a bazillion different types. I mean, it's one form of violence to rape and torture and mutilate and kill a child, and it's another form of violence entirely to step in and stop a person from doing that. And it's one form of violence to eat a carrot, and it's another form of violence to eat a cow, and it's another form of violence to, you know, those are all different. You can't use one word to describe all of them, but nonetheless, we're going to use that just like resource. We're going to condense it all for a second. Love doesn't imply pacifism. That a lot of people say if you just love enough that you would never do any act of violence. And I don't think that Mother Grizzly Bears would agree. I have a newspaper article above the space where I work that says, the headline is Mother Bear Charges Trains. And the trains had killed her two sons, and so she began to charge every train that came by. I grew up around animals, and I've lived around animals my whole life. And in my life, I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, chickens, hawks, eagles, hummingbirds, spiders, and mice who thought that I was attacking their children. And if a mother mouse is going to attack someone 6,000 times her size to protect those she loves, What's going on with us? She won, by the way. I think I'd like to read a couple things, and then I'd like to read three things, and then we'll do Q&A. Part of the problem really is identification. That's a really central part. With what or whom do you identify? The mother mouse identified with herself and those she loved. And Oh, it's kind of like the other day. Somebody said to me, so how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, I didn't know we were in Iraq. I thought we were in Northern California. And the friend said, it's like, Derek, do I have to put up with this shit all the time? You know what I meant? How much longer do you think our soldiers are going to be in Iraq? And I said, they're not my soldiers. There's this great bumper sticker I saw, US out of North America. I really like that. So it's like, with whom do you identify? The attorney at that dinner was saying, you know, if we can take over the White House, she's identifying with the Democrats. Once again, with whom or what do you identify? Do you identify with your own body? Do you identify with your land base? Do you identify, you know, what are the things that are worth living for? What are the things that are worth dying for? What are the things that are worth fighting for? What are the things with whom and with what you identify? Anyway, so here's a little story about that. I go to the post office. Jim, my favorite clerk there, with whom I often chat as he processes the packages I'm mailing, comments on the heat. It's 85 or 86. He says, the second or third highest temperature on record here. I live in cool Northern California. It makes you think about global warming, he says. I nod and reply, 19,000 people dead in Europe from the heat. The damn newspapers don't even mention global warming. I don't mention that this is more than six times the number killed in the attacks on the World Trade Center. Jim likes my politics, but polite discourse generally demands we ignore many obvious things. Now it's his turn to nod. He says, did you see those pictures of glaciers melting in Europe? The climate's changing, I say, and those in power won't do anything about it. The culture has too much momentum, he responds, and those in charge have too much money and power for us to stop them. That's why, I say, my next book is about how to take down civilization. He looks at me for a moment. You can write a book about it, but you can't make it happen. I can help push in the right direction at the right times. I think that can make a difference. It'll come down all right, he says, and that pretty soon, but it won't be your doing. It'll be the system collapsing in on itself. This is a guy at the post office. There are many who know this, but few who speak it out loud. I say, we can hurry it up. It's going to be nasty, he responds. It already is nasty, I say. That nastiness is exactly why I bought a gun, he said, a 38. I'm about to say that's also exactly why I bought a gun a few years ago, but he carries my packages in the big bins and back. When he returns, he says, it's for myself. I don't know what he means. He says, I don't want to live like that. I say, I don't want to live like this. He says, I don't want to live like an animal. I say, I got news for you, Jim. You already are an animal. He says, I need my electricity. I can't live without it. I don't say anything. I think, is it worth it to you? He looks me straight in the eyes and says, I'm going to retire in January. Don't do this right now. Give me a couple years to enjoy my retirement. Okay, two more things to read. I want to say a couple more things first. One of them is that the most common words I ever hear spoken by any environmentalist anywhere were fucked. We're so fucked. So several years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine one night saying, she's a long-time environmentalist, saying, this work is just killing me. It's so hard. It's really painful. I said, yeah, I know it is. Then she said, unless it stopped, the dominant culture is going to kill everything on the planet, didn't it? I said, yeah, it is. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, it hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. And then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew was best to say all along, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I said that to her is because about 10 years ago, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just bursting into sobs several times a week. And, you know, I'd cry over the salmon, the grizzlies, so much. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, you know, Derek, just back off because the problems will be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew if tears are going to mean anything, I mean, if you're not going to cry over the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? And so one day I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian writer, activist, and I said, this work's really hard. It's really painful. It's killing me. She said, yeah, I know it does that. And I said, we're not going to make it to some... No, I didn't say that first. I said, unless it stops, the dominant culture is going to kill everything, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is. And I said, it has death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. And I said, it hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could say is because it normalized my despair. It let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that I could feel the pain and the sorrow, and it's just pain and sorrow. You know, it's just pain, it's just sorrow. And it's not so much the pain and sorrow that hurts as it is my resistance to it. And it let me know that I could feel all of those things and it wouldn't kill me. Or even better, that it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. The logic of the Nazis doesn't work on you anymore. And a question I get sometimes is, if things are so bad, why don't you just kill yourself? And the answer is that life is really, really good. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really fucked and that life's really, really good. And there's a strange notion that if you understand how bad things are, that you have to go around being miserable all the time. But I'm actually really happy. And I'm really sad. I'm really full of rage. I'm full of joy. I'm full of a lot of things. I mean, it's like this person sent me an email a while back saying she wanted to know how my anger at the dominant culture affects my sex life. And I was really tempted to write back, you know, that's a question to which she will never know the answer. And what I was, I mean, but I really thought about it, and it's based on the idea that if you're angry, that your anger has to be a shotgun. But surprisingly enough, you know, if some specific person makes me angry, I can be angry at them. And if some specific thing makes me angry, I can be angry at it. That doesn't mean I have to be angry at you. I may be, goddammit. That we can separate. And the other question that I get a lot is, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? And the answer is, I don't really like parties. I'm actually having a wonderful time. There's this great Irish proverb: is this a private fight or can anybody enter? And that question about if things are so bad, why don't you just party, used to bother me a lot until I realized that the question, the premise is, there we go again, that a premise of that question is that it really reveals nothing more nor less than an incapacity to love. Because if you love, you do what's appropriate to defend your beloved. And of course results matter to you, but they don't matter to whether you make the effort. I got this email from this guy not very long ago saying that his son is 15 years old and he's wonderfully active, working for social justice and ecological sanity and all those groovy things. And the problem is that he didn't know how to give his son hope, and he wanted his son to stay active. And I said, if you want your son to stay active, don't give him hope, give him love, and he'll stay active. Because hope, once again, is the whole powerless thing. So the other thing I want to read, there was a point to that story, I just don't remember what it was. I want to read this short, I'm not going to read this whole thing, but there's a couple lines here I really like. A wonderful thing happens when you give up on hope, which is that you realize you never needed it in the first place, kind of like a belief in a Christian heaven. You realize that giving up on hope didn't kill you nor even make you less effective. In fact, it made you more effective because you ceased relying on someone or something else to solve your problems. You ceased hoping your problems would somehow get solved through the magical assistance of God, the Great Mother, the Sierra Club, valiant tree sitters, brave salmon, or even the earth itself. And you just began doing what's necessary to solve the problems yourself. Okay, so that said, I have a confession to make, which is that I've been holding out on you. Quite a while ago, I had one of the most positive conversations I ever had. Makes me think it really could be possible to speed up the process of bringing down civilization. I talked with some hackers. I hope you'll forgive me if I don't tell you when or where we met or the oddly satisfying circumstances under which we met. I also won't say their names or genders, nor will I describe them. Presume they're men. Presume one of them looks like your bench partner from your high school advanced laboratory class. And the other looks strangely familiar too, like someone you saw once in the far corner of a library surrounded by books on Nestor Makhno, Emiliano Zapata, August Spies, and Albert Parsons. Or maybe it looks like someone you saw standing at the very back of an auditorium as you listened to someone speak passionately about the necessity of taking down civilization now. In any case, here I am, sitting across the table, at least you can presume I'm sitting across the table, from these folks sharing a pitcher of water at a cafe. Let's presume we're in Asheville, North Carolina. It's late, very late on a hot summer night. Let's start small, I say. Would it be possible to inflict serious economic damage on a major corporation by hacking into computer systems? You're presuming, responds the first one, let's call him Brian, that this doesn't happen already. The other, let's call him Dean, nods. I look back and forth between the two. Brian continues, it's in the corporation's best interest not let on that this stuff happens all the time. Why is that, I ask. You think they want people to know how easy it is to hack into a system? He winks, then pauses for effect. It's getting easier all the time. Take the use of wireless technologies that have come on strong these past few years. See that thermostat over there? He points to the far side of the room. Those are oftentimes computerized and send and receive signals through the air from a main system. The other day I hacked into the main computer of a major corporation through the thermostat. My jaw drops. He throws back his head and laughs and says, I didn't do anything. I was just trying to see if I could do it. But could you have done damage? Oh, yeah. How? Name a nasty corporation, he says. Ha, says Dean. Name one that isn't. Freeport McMoRan is pretty nasty. They both shake their heads. Most polluting company in the United States, pollutes all over the world, machine guns natives in Erie and Giant, imprisons others in shipping crates. Dean looks at me intently before asking, how does it make its money? Mainly mining. Gold in Indonesia, sulfur in the Gulf of Mexico, other minerals too. Okay, Dean says, piece of cake. What do you do, I ask. Mess with their bank accounts, pretend it's Fight Club and destroy their credit card accounts? Brian wrinkles his nose. Dean says, shipping. All the shipping these days is computerized. Brian interrupts to ask, did you know the U.S. economy almost ground to a halt last year? What? I exclaim. The dock workers strike on the West Coast, Dean says. The big companies couldn't get their raw materials and parts. They were within a day or two of running out. Do you know what happens then? It's clear the question's rhetorical. He asks another question. Do you know how much it would cost GM to shut down its assembly line? I have no idea. Millions of dollars per minute. Jesus, I say. No, Brian responds, dock workers. Or, Dean says, hackers. Let's say Freeport McMoRan ships through Singapore. Singapore is the most automated port in the world. What happens if you reroute canister after canister headed for New Orleans instead to Honduras, Belize, Istanbul? The people who work for these companies, Brian adds, rely more on computers than common sense. They have to. The companies are so big, the movements of people and resources so complicated, the people can't keep track of it all. Last month, I hacked into the security system of a major corporation and had the computer issue me an ID card. I went to the company headquarters, swiped the card, and it okayed me to enter. I walked over to security people and told them I was a hacker who just breached their security. They refused to believe me. They said the computer okayed me, so I should just quit joking and head on in. I tried to persuade them, but nothing I said convinced them to listen to me. Do you think, I asked, that hackers could do more than just mess with a big corporation or two? Brian smiles. You're presuming again that nobody's already doing this. No, I say. Do you think they could bring it all down, could take down civilization? Brian nods, and so does Dean. Dean says, I've spent the past 20 years studying how the economic system works. I don't mean economic theory, although I certainly understand that, but rather the nuts and bolts of it, transport of raw materials like we were talking about with those canisters. And the thing that amazes me is that the system hasn't already collapsed. It's incredibly fragile, incredibly vulnerable. As Dean talks, Brian pulls what looks like a walkie-talkie from a holster on his belt. The walkie-talkie has a small LED. Suddenly the machine squawks and the light turns green. Guess what, Brian says, somebody in Asheville is receiving a page. He pulls a hand calculator from another holster and punches a few buttons. He shows me the screen. I read information about the page. He smiles proudly, then says, I made a few minor modifications. I ask, why do you do this? It makes me giddy to figure things out. I love the rush when I suddenly understand something new. I know the feeling. I feel what I'd imagine is the same rush whenever I suddenly get the relationship, for example, between pornography and science. I ask, if you love computers, would you take it down? Dean says, yes. Brian says, in a heartbeat. Why? Do you know where they put computer books in bookstores, Brian asks? In the business section. And? Computers were supposed to set us free. That was the rhetoric. That's always the rhetoric. But they've just been used to further enslave us, to further enslave the poor, to further enslave the planet. I become aware of the silence in the room. I take a sip of water. Brian continues, let's say you have a soldering iron that you love to use. You love soldering pieces of metal together. You love burning beautiful designs into pieces of wood furniture. Now, what would you do if somebody started using that soldering iron to torture people? I can't speak for you or anybody else, but I would pull the plug on the iron. I'd do that, he repeats, in a heartbeat. A soft sound breaks the silence of the cafe. Across the room, the lone employee has begun stacking chairs on tables. Brian says, I'm in love with figuring out how things work, and the existence or non-existence of machines doesn't mean we can't figure things out. If I smash this calculator, that doesn't invalidate Ohm's law. Ohm's law is still there. Nature is still there under all the concrete, under all these machines. And if you've gone outside during a blackout, the lights are still there, but they're up in the sky. And it's so quiet, you can finally start to hear. I ask again, and you'd be willing to help bring it down. Doorman is stacking chairs closer. We don't have much time. They both laugh and say, of course. You've thought about this a lot. Again, both laugh and say, of course. I have to know. If they were dedicated enough and knew what they were doing, how many people do you think it would take to bring it all down? Brian says it would take far fewer than Jesus had apostles. Doorman has stacked all the chairs but ours. Dean says, let's go. I nod and say, it's late. It is... What? Okay, there's one more thing I want to say. And then we'll do like 30 seconds of Q&A. I'll ask one question. And I'll ask it myself and answer it myself. There we go. Okay, so there's one more thing I do want to talk about, which is there was a woman who came to one of my talks in Eugene. Actually came to two of my talks on the same day because in both of them she wanted to accuse me of being a combination of Mao and Stalin. Because bringing down civilization is all nice and theoretical, but the truth is there will someday be a lot fewer people on the planet than there are now. And so she was basically accusing me of wanting to commit mass murder by wanting to bring down civilization. And the first thing I said is, of course, the people of... I was talking to Anuradha Mittal a few years ago, and I said, would the people of India be better off if the U.S. economy disappeared tomorrow? And she said, of course they would. And the example she gave, and this has to do with Europe, but it's the same deal. There are former granaries of India that are now exporting dog food and tulips to Europe. And there are people in India starving to death because of that. So that's one thing. And another thing is that the idea of bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. I mean, I don't care if you are an anarcho-primitivist or a U.S. soldier, blowing up a children's hospital is an atrocity. It doesn't matter who you are and or what your motivation is. And at the same time, I think it's really hard to make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. Cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds a year. And I mean, sure, we can make up a case. So we got this woman driving along late at night, and her car dies out on this lonely country road. And so she dials 911. The cops say he's going to come and help her start a car. And she turns on the radio, and she hears that this homicidal maniac just escaped from a prison. He's got a hook on his arm. And then the cop comes, and he starts the car. And she drives away. And the next morning, when she goes out and looks at her car, there's this bloody hook hanging from the arm. And it's just like, whew. Cell phones should stay up. But on the other hand, you got this story, you got this woman driving down the road late at night, she calls her mom, and her mother's this elderly woman who falls down the stairs and breaks her leg, and then grabs the phone and says, please call 911, I'm lying on the floor in tremendous pain. Fortunately, the woman has two cell phones, so she dials 911 with the other cell phone, but then she's, of course, driving with no hands, and she veers off the road, she hits three orphans, and then runs into a tree, and the last thing she sees before she passes out is this hook gleaming in the moonlight. The point being that, you know, you can make up hypotheticals for, you know, to make yourself do or not do any action. But there are some actions that it'd be really hard to make a moral case against. That said, I still couldn't proceed with the book because someday, because humans are over carrying capacity. Primary problem isn't population anyway. The primary problem the primary problem is a worldview based on a refusal to acknowledge limits, but the secondary problem is consumption, and the tertiary problem is population. But in any case, there'll be less people. So what are we going to do about that? What does that mean? I couldn't finish the book until I had... It's like, I don't want to gloss over it. That's a huge, huge thing. How are we going to get there? And I finally came up with an answer that really works for me. If you've got... And the point really also is if you're civilized, your hands are bloody. So there's no way we can step away. I mean, you can't just sit here... I got a call a couple years ago from this woman at WGBH, a producer for the public radio or public TV show there. She said she was going to do a program on Kaczynski, but she wanted to make sure that she didn't glorify a killer. And I said, that's so good. I'm so glad you're not going to glorify a killer. And I hope that if you did a biography of George Bush or Bill Clinton or Al Gore, you would hold them to the same standards. And she said, I have no idea what you're talking about, which, of course, is why she's a producer for WGBH. And then I said, you know, look, do you pay taxes? She said, yes. And I said, well, in that case, you've killed way more people than Ted Kaczynski because, of course, you support the U.S. military. And oddly enough, I didn't end up in a documentary. anyway, so the point is we're all inculpated, which we could talk about if we had more time. Anyway, if you've gotten this far in the book, we probably agree that civilization's going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't believe that, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about them cubbies? We probably also agree the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner it comes down, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. So these are the premises. If you agree civilization is not going to last, if you agree the crash is going to be messy, and if you agree that the longer we wait, the worse it's going to be, because if you agree with all those, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring it down, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization is going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan and they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people... Thank you. We need people... You can clap about it, but you can't do it. We need people to... That was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft. We need people to protest and chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing.
Yes!
The truth is that although I don't believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so f***ed up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. This doesn't mean that everyone taking out dams and everyone working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. I have a new catchphrase: dismantle globally, renew locally. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. This doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what'll work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It is contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. So, thank you.
You've been listening to Derek Jensen speaking last February at the 3rd Annual Sustainable Living Conference in Olympia, Washington. He is the author of many books, including The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, Listening to the Land, and the soon-to-be-completed Bringing Down Civilization. He has a website, derekjensen.org, spelled DERICKJENSEN.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. This week, we'll conclude our reading of the book Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. We've been reading weekly installments from Disciplined Minds since last October. Last week, I began Chapter 16, the book's final chapter, entitled Now or Never. In this chapter, the author deals with practical strategies for radical professionals working in mainstream jobs, how to maintain one's values, and how to work from within the system to agitate and advocate for one's values. Where I left off last week, I was going through a list of 33 different actions suggested by the author. And this week, I'll pick up with number 14, which is, conspire with radicals in your workplace and in other workplaces to tilt your professional work and theirs to the left, so that it favors as much as possible those with less wealth and power. Also, you recommend knowledgeable radicals for non-radicals to consult in carrying out their assignments. Number 15. Help coworkers understand that their conflicts with local authority, their department or division managers, have more to do with the actual social function of the institution as a whole than with the personalities of the managers. When managers are not around and coworkers get together and talk informally, the most common topics are office politics, rumors, gossip, and personalities, all of which tend to focus on power in the workplace. Office politics addresses the subject directly. Rumors often concern what those in power are planning to do. Gossip mainly has to do with the things coworkers may be doing to escape their quote-unquote place. And when personalities are the topic, the bosses get much more than their fair share of attention, as their personalities are analyzed and reanalyzed ad infinitum. You participate in these discussions, understanding that those with little power and information must, for their own protection, monitor every move of those who have more power and information. But as a radical, you also try to broaden the discussion to deal with the systemic origins of the conflicts, why they persist even as various management personalities come and go. You help coworkers understand how many of their grievances have their origin in the workplace hierarchy and the assigned ideology that goes along with it, the very ideology that guides their work. You explain how the workplace hierarchy goes hand in hand with the assigned ideology, so that the struggle against one must involve a struggle against the other. As a workplace radical, you are more than someone who favors militancy in the fight for your coworkers' economic demands. You draw a connection so as to spread understanding of how the system works and why it must be changed. Number 16. Help coworkers and others to acknowledge the forbidden and difficult to accept truth pointed to by their own conflicts and frustrations. Hierarchical organizations are fundamentally flawed. This acknowledgement will in turn stimulate them to develop their own vision of how the workplace should be organized, making them harder to manage and ultimately forcing the management to make democratic concessions. Most situations that cause employees anxiety and stress would be only minor problems if the individuals involved had equal shares of power. Thus, to those who have experienced conflict, your radical democratic views will at least make sense. You offer these individuals all the hard-won lessons of how structural inequality is bad news. 6 examples. First, hierarchical organizations take the fun out of work. They centralize decision-making so that most people involved in an activity or project are deprived of creative control, alienating them from their own work and killing their enthusiasm. This makes individuals less productive. Ever notice how people work hardest on self-assigned projects and leaves them less fulfilled? Nobody says, "Wow, you work in a hierarchy? That must be fun." Second, Hierarchical power structures twist people's personalities. The skills people develop for surviving in hierarchies are different from those they would develop in a democratic setup. As one secretary where I work confided proudly to another, "I know who's asked to kiss around here." Third, hierarchical power structures are necessarily secretive. Executives make key decisions behind closed doors. The hierarchical structure keeps people in the dark, even about issues that affect them directly, and engenders rumors. Fourth, hierarchical power structures create repressive environments. They produce fear and insecurity, killing free expression and spontaneous activity. People huddle and talk in hushed tones. CYA governs their work. Criticisms of the status quo and trial and error are necessary for progress, and so hierarchical power structures slow progress. Fifth, hierarchical power structures stunt personal development. They cause conformist behavior by increasing the personal risk associated with creativity, independent thinking, and dissent. They narrow the scope of each individual's work, ensuring that most people do not experience a wide variety of activity. In these and other ways, hierarchy deprives individuals of the environment of freedom and experimentation necessary for personal growth. Sixth, hierarchical power structures are inherently violent. The few can't maintain their authority over the many through rhetoric alone. Although bosses, for example, rarely use guards or police, their right to do so influences people's behavior, most obviously during individual confrontations and strikes. More importantly, on a daily basis, hierarchies subordinate and humiliate, and, as mentioned, make people's working lives a grind, warp their personalities, perpetuate their ignorance, repress their spontaneity, and stunt their personal development, amounting to a kind of violence against the individual. Some individuals respond with actual violence. Those pushed over the edge tend to go crazy in a particular way, aiming their guns up the hierarchy more often than down. But more commonly, people respond with many nonviolent forms of resistance, or with redirected violence such as alcohol and drug abuse and domestic brutality. All six problems mentioned here, and certainly others, are endemic to hierarchy, and so you can point out that they will eventually arise in every hierarchical system, be it an economic system such as capitalism, which is inherently hierarchical because authority originates in ownership, or a hierarchical workplace, political organizations, social or volunteer organizations, or personal relationship. Any such social grouping can be organized non-hierarchically, and is always more human when it is. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, reading from Chapter 16, the book's final chapter, titled Now or Never. And this is number 17 of the actions radicals can take in the workplace. Write and publish an exposé of the organization that employs you. You can do this as a public service to demystify one of society's institutions and to give insight into the workings of such organizations in general. You detail the way the bosses treat employees and the way they fashion the organization's products or services for clients and the public, showing the objectives that explain both. This look behind the scenes will not only entertain readers and enlighten them about the true nature of the organization, but will also force the bosses to curb some of their excesses. You make this a group effort if you can, and probably publish the result under a pseudonym. Number 18. Sharpen and deepen your coworkers' dissatisfaction with the restrictions on their work. If a coworker shows no such dissatisfaction, stir some up. Through its misrepresentation of the nature of the professional, the culture instills in those who aspire to go to professional school expectations of autonomy and of creative and fulfilling work. Professional training itself, however, is a process not of building up such expectations, but of cooling them out. And it usually succeeds in getting individuals to be, quote, realistic, that is, to accept strict limits on their expectations. You encourage any expectations that have survived. You explain that boring or narrow jobs are not natural, but are the result of the way the system divides labor to serve employer interests at the expense of both employees and clients. You support individual, professional, and non-professional co-workers in their struggles to be allowed to do work that is more interesting, more challenging, more fulfilling, or better for furthering their personal development. But you bring out how such struggles are fights with the system. You encourage co-workers to experiment and innovate in carrying out their work assignments, and you support their struggles to be allowed to exercise initiative, explaining how the restrictions on such activity originate in the hierarchical system rather than in the style or personality of one or another manager. With the same explanation, you fight against dead-end jobs and support people's struggles for work that will further their careers. It is not possible to draw a line that separates political and economic demands. Number 19. Help lay bare the intimate details of management's decision-making about the content of the work. Because workplace secrecy increases the power of the bosses by ensuring that they are the only ones with a comprehensive knowledge of what is going on, you work to spread around as much information as possible. When you know the details of how the bosses made a particular decision, you inform people inside and outside of the organization, and you encourage co-workers to do the same. This helps reveal management's politics and enables people to predict its decisions in the future. Number 20. Encourage openness in personnel matters, specifically in individual terms of employment. Secrecy allows management to avoid the pressure of precedence so that it can give each employee the cheapest deal it can get away with. With openness, all employees would have the precedent of the best deal. Hence, you encourage co-workers to reveal details with management. And yes, you advocate making lists of salaries public. The bosses strongly discourage such openness and are often extremely angry when it occurs. Not because they're out to, quote, protect your privacy, but because they are out to protect themselves from the cost of satisfying employees who have discovered the details of how they are being taken advantage of. Number 21. Encourage openness in personnel matters, specifically in individual disputes with management. When you have a dispute with management, the bosses insist on discussing it with you behind closed doors, not because they want to protect your privacy, but because they want to deny you the support of co-workers. Behind closed doors, you stand alone against the institution. Hence, you try to handle conflict. 3-1. Hence, you try to handle conflicts with the boss in front of co-workers to whatever extent possible. In any case, you recount the details of your disputes to co-workers, and you encourage co-workers to do the same when they have disputes with management. Number 22. Encourage co-workers to use their collective strength to maintain their individual dignity. You encourage employees to take their grievances to management collectively rather than individually. In the typical one-on-one meeting in the manager's office, the boss pretends to treat the employee as an equal, and the employee either plays along with the pretense to avoid humiliation or is disarmed by it out of desperation for an ego boost. In either case, the indignity is there. In a collective meeting, power is more equal. In general, you support non-professionals and other professionals when they go up against the institution alone. Number 23. Fight to get professional organizations to handle grievances. That is, to consider it their business to intervene in personnel matters on behalf of individual members. The availability of such backing would put members in a much better position to challenge their employers on the political content of the work. Number 24. Help organize a union. After all, management is organized and sticks together to defend its interests. Number 25. Undermine management's ability to manipulate employees. You become an expert on management tactics and tricks. You become an expert on the principles of resistance, and you spread this knowledge throughout the workplace. The excerpts in Chapter 15 from the Army Field Manual are a great starting point. That chapter discussed the manual primarily in terms of the training institution, but I'm sure that every reader who has ever worked as a professional immediately recognized the manual's relevance to the workplace as well. Hire coworkers on the basis of character. When there are job openings at the workplace, managers sometimes ask professionals on the staff to meet some of the applicants and comment on them. Typically, the bosses will have already filtered out the ones who don't have the technical ability to do the job. So you need to ask only one question. And if you can talk to the candidates outside the presence of managers, you can ask it directly. What do you stand for? Or perhaps even more to the point, in a world where flexibility has become the key to marketability, do you stand for anything? You are simply trying to find out what the person will fight for, if anything. The managers will be sorting the interviewees by character, too, looking for team players, management's euphemism for people who stand for nothing of their own. Number 27. Fight elitism, authoritarianism, and hierarchy by resisting a professional self-identity. Your academic degree and job title do a lot to shape your workplace identity. But don't let your fancy credentials go to your head and shape your self-identity. Whenever you have a choice in your interactions with coworkers and clients and with people in your life outside the workplace, you downplay your formal education and your position within the system, recognizing that that would be elitist to imply that such credentials make you even a bit more deserving of respect than other people. When you identify yourself, don't adorn your name with titles such as Doctor, PhD, Professor, or Esquire, because fighting elitism is at the top of your agenda as a radical. You realize that no matter how much farther you might advance your progressive views on one or another issue by flaunting your credentials, such elitist behavior would do even more to set back your ultimate goals. In fact, even if all you care about was prevailing on just one issue at hand, and you didn't care if you promoted elitism in the process, arguing from authority would still be counterproductive. Or if your own degree and job title lend validity to your conclusions, then the paper credentials and positions of your establishment-oriented colleagues lend validity to the opposition conclusions. And there are more of them than there are of you. For every radical in your field, there may be dozens of establishment-oriented professionals, many with academic degrees and job titles fancier than yours. And so any implication that a person's formal education or position within the system lends validity to that person's political views does more for the other side than it does for yours. Hence, the use of system-based authority against the system itself, always a temptation for some, is a double loser. As a radical, you realize that the system of authority works against you. Some of the most backward things that you have ever heard have come from well-educated, quote, authorities, and you realize that you therefore have no choice but to work against the system of authority. Take it from me, an authority on expertise. You can't trust experts. Your gut reaction to system-based credentials is more one of suspicion than of respect, because you see their underside. A person's flashy diploma or job title, for example, brings to your mind the degree to which that person has been processed by the system, is trusted by the system, or is concerned about keeping the system's trust. In your own case, you don't worry about being respectable by the system's measure. You give respect and expect to receive it according to your own measure. in which commitment to the opposition counts and success within the system does not. And you are careful not to give the system credit for such commitment. You understand the politics of professional qualification too well to think that the progressive outlook of oppositional professionals is due to the enlightening effect of their extensive formal education. You know that when professionals have good politics, it is not because of their professional training, but in spite of it. Finally, you don't let rank within the system determine rank or authority within the anti-system movement, as often happens in professional associations. Many people check out the opposition because the elitist system turns them into nobodies. Opposition groups that do the same thing by honoring system-based credentials and thereby importing hierarchies from the system should not wonder why few people stick around. People subordinate themselves to authority at work because they are paid to do so, and even then they resist. Few are about to do so voluntarily. Number 28. Work to democratize your field, to break down the hierarchy within it. You draw attention to the establishment connections of the field's establishment. Number 29. Use your position within the system to help other radicals. Commitment to the opposition usually involves career and financial sacrifices. You help counterbalance these by helping radicals to get jobs, by supplying them with references and recommendations, by giving them access to the resources and products of the organization that employs you, by making available to them free or at cost professional services, and by helping them get anything else you can from the system. When you give someone this kind of help, you don't see yourself as doing the individual a personal favor, but as helping the movement. You expect no return or special thanks, because you see yourself as simply fulfilling the obligation of a radical who has a professional position within the system. You expect to receive such help yourself when you need it, and you recognize the right of radicals to expect it from you. Number 30. Work to abolish professionals. That is, you work to eliminate the professional-nonprofessional division of labor, not only because it stunts the intellectual development of people on both sides of the division, but also because it works against democracy in society. If knowledge is power, then a truly democratic society is impossible without the broad distribution of expertise throughout the population. Thus, you encourage non-professional co-workers, clients, and others to gain some technical understanding and skills of your profession. Many of the most useful skills are simple and can be learned quickly. You take the time to apprentice people to minimize their dependence on professionals. You give away your skills. Number 31. Build solidarity between professionals and non-professionals by encouraging your professional co-workers to see themselves as labor and by discouraging them from seeing themselves as superior to labor. Salaried professionals are workers who have been hired to carry on intellectual labor under the guidance of an assigned ideology. The mental contortions that professionals have to perform to maintain the pretense that they are superior to labor and that they are ideologically self-directed are stifling and unhealthy. Dropping the pretense and acknowledging that you are a rank-and-file member of the ideologically directed intellectual workforce opens the door to many forms of resistance and is personally empowering. The staff professional's universal complaint, "They treat us like wage laborers here," should lead not to demands for special privileges for professionals, but to specific demands for better treatment of all the institution's employees. To strengthen professionals for this struggle, you encourage them to identify not with the institution, but with labor, to see themselves as renting their abilities to the system for a certain number of hours per week, to resist working longer hours than the non-professionals in the organization, and to expect overtime compensation when they do. but most important, to take the attitude that they do not want to serve the assigned ideology a minute longer than they have to. Finally, you avoid subtle put-downs of non-professionals. For example, when you argue that a particular group of professionals deserves higher salaries, you don't use arguments that imply that professionals have some sort of natural or moral right to have a higher standard of living than non-professionals. You argue that the professionals deserve a raise because they are exploited, that is, because the value of their work to the employers is greater than that of their pay, not because plumbers or bus drivers out-earn them. You don't subscribe to the notion that someone who has been privileged enough to spend many years in college and who gets to do work that offers many non-monetary rewards should be naturally rewarded with a salary higher than that of non-professionals. That is, reward privilege is not part of your ideology. Number 32. Undermine management's information advantage. Management's knowledge of what is going on in workplaces throughout the industry, throughout the country, and throughout the world gives it tremendous advantage over labor in its own workplace, allowing it to judge rather precisely just how much it can get away with. Its historical knowledge of struggles with labor allows it to fine-tune this judgment. To cut management's advantage, you arm your coworkers with as much information about the big picture as possible. You simply want your fellow employees to know and use to their advantage what top management already knows and uses to its advantage, that their grievances are not unique, that their own workplace is just one of many battle sites in a widespread contest between labor and management, and that they have much to gain by following the overall struggle. You get a lot of your information by reading the very same publications that your institution's top management reads to get its broad perspective. These almost certainly include the Wall Street Journal, as well as the appropriate trade publications. If the institution deals with academics, for example, the Chronicle of Higher Education would be required reading. The best way to judge a publication, and at the same time determine how useful it might be to you, is to figure out its role in society. The above-mentioned newspapers make good examples. The Wall Street Journal is for decision-makers, not just those in business, but all decision-makers throughout a society that is dominated by business. Unlike the New York Times and other newspapers for wider audiences, and contrary to popular mythology, the Journal does not push the establishment's side in its reporting. It serves the establishment in a different way by informing its members from an above-the-fray perspective, trusting them to come to their own conclusions. One of its most important functions is to give top managers the comprehensive social intelligence they must have if they are to boss their employees effectively and market to the public successfully. Thus, the Journal keeps its subscribers up to date on contemporary sociology and popular culture, giving the bosses the intimate details of the lives and aspirations of individuals at each and every level of society, from Skid Row on up, while always quickly reporting on anyone who is doing something out of the ordinary. The fact that the Journal does not use photographs, together with a widespread but innocent belief that it contains only boring financial data and articles that praise the system, help keep the wrong eyes from seeing the big picture. The Chronicle of Higher Education is a weekly intelligence report for university bosses, focusing primarily on ideology. It keeps administrators on top of the ideological battles that are going on within each of the many fields of research, and it reports on newly produced ideology the moment it appears in books, journal articles, or talks. It also keeps administrators up to the minute on student culture, reporting in great detail the attitudes and activities of college students across the country and around the world. And of course, it briefs administrators on academic labor disputes. If reading such establishment publications keep you as informed as local management, then adding the opposition press to your reading list propels your awareness beyond that of your bosses, but you don't give them any tips. Number 33. Help liberate non-professionals and professionals themselves from the mystique of the professional. One way that you demystify professionals is by making clear their role in the system of production, whose caste can be analyzed like this. Non-professional employees follow assigned procedures. Professional employees follow assigned ideologies. Employers critically assess ideologies and develop ideologies to assign. And undermining this not-so-happy hierarchy from within, a subgroup of non-professional and professional employees, radicals, critically assess ideologies and develop and propagate democratic ideologies that challenge the employer's elite-serving ideologies. You also explain the politics of professional qualification. The criterion for certification as a professional is not just technical knowledge, but also attitude, specifically an uncritical attitude. You want everyone to understand the politics of professional qualification at least as well as those who hire and fire professionals understand it. Note from the descriptions listed above that the radical of all people is on an intellectual par with the employer. Both see the big picture and know the utmost importance of ideology. Only the radical, however, wants to bring other employees up to this higher level of understanding. Explaining the division of labor and the politics of professional qualification is a step in that direction. At stake is not only the nature of the workplace and society, but your own nature as well, your very identity. The system of education and employment works to redefine who you are in the deepest sense, pushing you away from developing and acting upon your own vision and guiding ideas. Hence, if you want to stand for something and avoid vanishing as an independent force in society, you have no choice but to resist. Certainly, resisting the system carries some risk. But not resisting is a far deadlier course for your individual identity. And that was the conclusion of Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. Jeff, if you're listening, I'd like to personally thank you for writing this book. And I'd like to encourage everyone to read this book and get others to read it. If you'd like to find out more about the book Disciplined Minds or how to obtain it, you can visit on the web www.disciplinedminds.com. And if you'd like to download MP3s of our previous programs that contain readings of Disciplined Minds, or to contact us on the show for any reason, please visit our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.